Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Another weekend, another storm threatening Florida.
We expect this storm to become a hurricane and bring severe weather, including tropical storm force winds, to the Florida Panhandle this weekend.
Also this week, parts of Florida are still rebuilding in the wake of last month's Hurricane Irma.
We wanted to kind of rebuild and get something bigger. That's what we had been looking into anyways.
We'll also get an update on the growing exodus of Puerto Rican residents to Florida and learn how that relocation could wind up having an almost immediate impact on the politics of the Sunshine State. And Florida's war on human trafficking is focusing even more on the customers for that traffic. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. We start this week's edition of Capitol Report with a weather brief. Florida's western panhandle, the one area of the state spared the impact of Hurricane Irma nearly a month ago, is expected to get winds, surging water, and rain this weekend from fast-moving Tropical Storm Nate. A hurricane watch was in effect this afternoon in Florida from the Alabama border to the county line of Okaloosa and Walton counties. A tropical storm watch was in place from the Walton County line to Indian Pass, which is south of Port St. Joe in Gulf County. A storm surge watch covered the coast from the Alabama state line to Indian Pass, including Pensacola, Fort Walton Beach, and Panama City. A watch means the conditions could arise within the next 48 hours. Local officials haven't ordered coastal evacuations, but bridges will be closed if maximum sustained winds reach 40 miles an hour. A mid-afternoon forecast from the National Hurricane Center put Nate on course to become a hurricane Saturday afternoon, come ashore that night in Louisiana or Mississippi, and then veer east as a tropical storm. But even as a new storm looms on the horizon, the rebuilding from a previous storm continues. Nearly a month after Hurricane Irma washed 8 to 10 feet of storm surge onto Everglades City in southern Collier County, residents with damaged, unlivable homes are still waiting on emergency temporary housing. City officials estimate about 100 homes in the area are uninhabitable due to flood damage and mold. But officials say they expect relief within a week. From member station WGCU, Jessica Mazzaros takes us to Everglades City.
So this is our little place here.
Patty Demery is holding her youngest of five children, Augustus, on her hip. From the street, they're looking at what used to be their trailer home. Now, windows are missing, gray mud is spread across the lawn and patio deck, and there's a pile of debris in front of the property that's almost as long as the two-bedroom mobile home itself. But Demery says the worst of the damage is inside. Would it be okay to take a look?
Sure.
Oh, thanks.
Just be careful, that's muddy, and a lot of the mud is still here because this used to all be grass.
And water's still here.
Water's still here, yeah. Mm-hmm. And like this gray stuff on top, that's the mud that came in.
Oh, really? Into the house?
Also? Yeah, it settled everywhere. Can't get the door open. It's all... We've taken the carpet out so you can't see what was on top of the carpet, but if you go and look that direction, you can see how the water line is, and then all the mold started growing up.
Floodwaters left dark blotches a few feet high on the white walls of what used to be the kitchen. And above the waterline is spotted mold. Demery and her family gutted just about all of the trailer's insides.
How does it feel seeing it like this?
I don't know. I mean, you don't want it to be like this, but we wanted to kind of rebuild and get something bigger. That's what we had been looking into anyways. We were just kind of waiting for the time, and I guess the time is now.
And back the window.
What happened to the window?
And the hurricane broke it, and the glass fell down.
For now, Demaree's family is staying at her mother-in-law's house in Estero, more than an hour away. They make the commute daily for her husband's work, the kids' school, and after-school activities. She'd like to get some temporary housing in Everglades City while they rebuild.
Because it's hard to drive back and forth, and our kids play sports, so they've got practice and they've got games, and so it's been tough.
Demaree and her husband applied for assistance from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And she says she's been told they're going to get help, but she hasn't been given any details yet. Dan Summers is with Collier County Emergency Management. He says it's taken nearly a month to get temporary housing solutions for Everglades City residents because of an unusual combination of things.
Number one was how much impact the hurricane had on the federal system in Houston. The federal resources were heavily drained for that event. Number two, of course, is the almost 60 counties in Florida being impacted by Irma. So there was, again, a very large drain on state and federal assets. And then that's being compounded by the catastrophic conditions in Puerto Rico, where FEMA is also answering the call for service.
Summers says FEMA is planning to eventually use local hotels and rental properties to house the displaced people of Everglades City, as well as bring in mobile homes. Everglades City Interim Mayor Howie Grimm said Wednesday he expects temporary housing relief from FEMA in about a week.
We're not going to be forgotten. I'm not going to let us be forgotten. If I have to scream and holler at every person I get on the phone to get what they need, you know, I love the town, I love the people, you know, and it's all about family, and that's what we all are. I don't care where you came from. When you go through an experience like this, you become family. So we're going to look out for our family, and we're going to make it through it. It's going to be tough for a while, but we'll be fine.
Mayor Grimm says the long-term goal for housing in the Everglades City area of about 1,000 residents is to get every home on stilts to prevent this from ever happening again. I'm Jessica Mazaros in Everglades City.
A Florida House Republican today proposed a measure that seeks to ensure power restoration for nursing homes and hospitals is a priority after hurricanes and other emergencies. The bill that Tampa Republican Representative Sean Harrison filed comes after the deaths of residents of a Broward County nursing home that lost its air conditioning system September 10th because of Hurricane Irma. 8 residents of the Rehabilitation Center at Hollywood Hills died September 13th, and 4 more died later after the sweltering facility was evacuated. Harrison's bill, which is filed for the upcoming legislative session, would require a state comprehensive emergency management plan to include guidelines for restoring electrical service with prioritization of critical end-use facilities that would include hospitals and nursing homes. Still to come on Capitol Report, thousands of people who called Puerto Rico home may flee to Florida in the wake of their island's devastation.
It wasn't Puerto Rico. It was destroyed. All the trees were fallen in the highway. There was no food.
That Puerto Rican relocation could have an almost immediate impact on Florida's elections.
It behooves any elected official that's running for statewide office in Florida or that is running for any type of office in Central Florida to recognize that the Puerto Rican vote is a powerful one.
And a newly created task force is looking for ways to improve the state's transportation options for people with disabilities. For weeks, people living in the U.S. Commonwealth of Puerto Rico have been struggling with a lack of food, gasoline, and electricity. Now the American mainland is expecting an influx of people from that island. Florida Governor Rick Scott has declared a state of emergency in order to receive aid to help accommodate people from Puerto Rico. From member station WGCU in Fort Myers, Quincy Walters spoke with a family who just arrived from Puerto Rico this week.
A family is gathering for dinner at a home in Lehigh Acres. The house is still showing damage from Hurricane Irma. A part of the roof came down and leaked through the second-story floor. One night this week, Ariel Rivera, who lives here, went to Fort Lauderdale to pick up his family who fled Puerto Rico. He got them the first plane tickets that he could.
My niece, who's here with me, he lost everything. My mother-in-law, she suffered some damage. But it's not just so much that, it's also this, you know, where they're at that town, the help hadn't arrived yet. So they were down to the bitter end of the food.
Rivera says when Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, it took 5 stressful days for him to make contact with his family. His niece Nicole Reyes is from Coamo, Puerto Rico, a town in the southern part of the island. She's 8 months pregnant and has a 1.5-year-old son. Her mom, husband, and brother are still on the island.
There are a lot of people leaving the island because resources are running out. There's no gasoline, there's no diesel, the hospitals are closing. A lot of people lost their things, their homes, so we have to look for better for ourselves.
Reyes says she's hopeful her husband can join her here next week, but she's still worried about her family that remains. She says there's no communication and people don't know where to get essentials. When she left Puerto Rico, she says she felt it wasn't Puerto Rico anymore.
It was destroyed. It wasn't Puerto Rico. It was destroyed. All the trees were fallen and the highway. There was no food.
Reyes says it seems the government is paying more attention to metropolitan areas like San Juan, and places like Coamo are being overlooked. Ariel Rivera's mother-in-law, Ana Gonzalez, is also here. She says when she was on the plane to Florida, it was the first time in weeks that she was able to feel at peace.
Because in Puerto Rico, you have to wait for hours to get diesel for the generator. You have to stand on a 3-hour line just to get $100, and might not be enough money to get what you need.
Gonzalez says she feels the government is assisting the island the best it can for the conditions. Reyes and Gonzalez don't know when they'll go back to Puerto Rico because they say right now there's nothing to go back to. I'm Quincy Walters in Lehigh Acres.
The relocation of Puerto Rican residents to Florida could cause a seismic political shift, at least in some parts of the Sunshine State. Kate Payne reports many may settle in Florida's purple counties ahead of the 2018 election.
Florida's lawmakers are stepping up for Puerto Rico. The 3.4 million U.S. citizens who call the island home don't have a voting representative in Congress. Florida Senator Marco Rubio is taking on some of the responsibility.
I can tell you this, having lived through multiple storms in my whole life in a tropical, you know, subtropical region, nothing good happens after 8 days in the tropics without electricity, without water, and without food.
State Representative Renee Placencia of Orlando got to the island in the days after Maria made landfall. He was shocked by the lack of organization. He spoke with CBS's David Begno on September 28th.
We've got our own security team. We brought our own water. We brought our own food. We're not going to be a burden on anything that happens.
So you
here.
Need fuel and a vehicle. That's what you need.
That's what we need.
A contingent of Democratic state lawmakers also visited the island. Reports of the devastation and the utter lack of basic necessities continue to come forward. Thousands of residents are lining up at airports and marinas to get off the island. Governor Rick Scott declared a state of emergency and opened up shelters to accept them.
So they're going to come here, so we're going to do whatever we can. Do they need a job? Do they need housing? Do they need to find a family and friend? Is there a host family that can help them? Are their kids need to get into K-12 education?
Lawmakers, residents, and their families are urging the U.S. government to amp up a response that many are calling too little, too late. There are concerns that President Trump's handling of the crisis could reflect poorly on other Republican lawmakers. Esteban Garces with Hispanic outreach organization Mi Familia Vota says the 2018 stakes are high.
We have a gubernatorial election. We have a U.S. Senate seat that's up. We have many state Senate, all the state House races, many municipal elections. Across the I-4 corridor, where likely this Puerto Rican voting bloc is going to start settling in.
There are about 1 million Puerto Ricans already in Florida. By 2020, the community is expected to outnumber Florida's Cuban population, long thought to be the state's most significant Hispanic demographic. Florida International University professor Eduardo Gamarra spoke to WFSU about the rising power of Puerto Rican voters ahead of the 2016 elections.
One of the important things about them is that, in contrast to other Latinos or Hispanics, they are U.S. Citizens at birth, and while they can't vote on the island, as soon as they arrive in Florida, they can.
Garces says Puerto Rican activism is already visible in the I-4 corridor. That's the area between Tampa and Daytona Beach, Florida's epicenter of swing voters.
There were groups that were doing caravanas, which are something that you only really find on the island, but essentially it's caravans of loudspeakers and boisterous and joyous music encouraging people to go vote.
Garces says Puerto Rican voters are among the most politically engaged. Orange County attorney Anthony Suarez hopes to prove that. He's hosting family who fled the island.
My uncle, he's 81 years old. I don't know if he would want to stay here. He may go back. But my cousin, who is 54, she lost her job with the city. The city's out of, you know, basically bankrupt and out of business. Now, I don't know if she's going to want to go back to Puerto Rico to start all over again. If she's going to start all over again, she might as well stay here.
Suarez says he'll make sure his family will vote.
Well, I'm going to take my uncle and I'm going to take my cousin right down to the motor vehicles, get them an identification card and register them to vote.
According to state numbers, 6,000 Puerto Ricans have landed in Florida so far. The island's governor worries that number will continue to rise. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
The medical marijuana company Certera is urging state health regulators to take steps to allow edible cannabis treatments. But Nick Evans reports the rollout for those rules could still be far off on the horizon.
This is Certera's Tallahassee Wellness Center. The dispensary has been open for a few months, but recently celebrated its grand opening. The bright white walls are gleaming and boxes of donuts are piled on a large table just inside. About 30 patients are milling around, drinking coffee and checking out the different treatments.
You know, cleaning the house is exciting because I can do it. You know, changing the sheets on my bed all by myself, I can do it, you know, and I plan on keep on doing it. And
we've had our grandchildren live with us a couple different times, and I wasn't even able to take care of them. I couldn't take my grandson outside to play with them. And now I'm able to get up and go and do things. It used to be I wouldn't have even been able to come to this.
And I started in July, and today I'm 20 days seizure-free, which is a big deal for me.
That's Kathy Reeves, Brian Griffin, and Nicole Hill. They all offer variations on a testimonial that's become pretty familiar over the past few years. Conventional treatments for chronic conditions limited their quality of life, and they feel much better now that they're using cannabis instead. Hill explains her new routine.
I decided that I wanted to do the oil for me because it's more measurable, and I need a therapeutic level. I don't want peaks and valleys. I want to be able to be a mom. I want to be able to be a good wife, a good friend. I don't want to sleep all day and stay up all night. All those side effects, I just wanted to get rid of that.
Hill keeps a vape pen handy in case of emergencies and uses a journal to track her symptoms.
Well, we have tinctures, oils, sprays, and vaporizer pens.
This is Certera's president for Florida, Wesley Reynolds.
We'll be coming to market with edibles as well. You may have seen some things in the press that we're waiting for some rules to be written on edibles so that we can go ahead and bring those to patients that need them.
Edibles have proven controversial. While existing routes of administration work for Hill, Griffin, and Reeves, many supporters argue some patients need edible treatments. Detractors worry edibles could be harmful to children, but the law does allow for them once regulators make rules. Certera sent the state a petition for rulemaking September 29th, with a draft rule attached. Regulators don't have to follow Certera's lead, but the provisions are standard fare: labeling requirements, ingredients list, and expiration dates. Still, Gray Robinson attorney Jason Sattell warns developing rules won't be easy.
You're now combining the heavily regulated cannabis plant with regulated food to create this hybrid cannabis-infused edible product. So I think that's why it's unique and very complicated.
What's more, the rulemaking process is a well-defined procedure with specific timeframes for issuing proposals, taking public comments, and finalizing drafts. Once that's done, the whole thing is subject to challenge in an administrative court. Those steps are part of why it took Florida 2 years to deliver treatment under a medical cannabis measure approved in 2014. When it comes to regulating edibles, Sattell says a number of states are experimenting, but their approaches vary.
So they haven't perfected it yet. And I always like to draw this analogy to the regulation of alcohol.
He explains prohibition ended in 1933. And 80-odd years on, there's a shifting patchwork of laws governing alcohol across the country.
Alcohol laws are constantly changing. So it's going to take a century or so to finalize exactly how we want to regulate alcohol in this country. It's going to take a long time to regulate the cannabis industry.
The Office of Medical Marijuana Use in the Department of Health regulates Florida's burgeoning cannabis industry. A spokeswoman refused an interview request but explained in a statement the office is working to implement all the new law's requirements, including rules for edibles. There's no timeline for those rules, but there is a deadline for adding 10 new growers. That deadline was October 3rd. The office says Hurricane Irma and litigation delayed its work. They were only able to select 5 new licensees in time. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
As Florida continues to work to combat human trafficking, some experts say working to make sure everyone recognizes the signs is important, but equally important is going after the so-called Johns themselves. We get that story from Sasha Cordner.
We pride ourselves on having the largest international selection of women in the state. Just obey the rules. If we're going to get along, you break them, you get broke.
The movie Traffic follows the story of three young girls from India, Nigeria, and America who are trafficked and try to escape.
This film depicts for the first time the true side of human trafficking, taking the viewer on an emotional, gut-wrenching journey that he or she will never forget.
That's Hollywood actress Anne Archer. You might know her for her roles in movies like Fatal Attraction and Patriot Games. More recently, she spoke at this year's Human Trafficking Summit as an advocate for fighting the modern-day slavery practice. Archer also plays a nun in the trafficked film.
It's written by modern-day slavery expert Siddharth Kara, who is the director of the Human Trafficking Program at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And the movie offers an unflinching look at the pain and suffering inherent in sex trafficking.
Archer said what also sets the movie apart is how it portrays Johns, or the sex buyers.
Siddharth Kara estimates that there are anywhere between 21 to 46 million slaves in the world today, generating profits that exceed $150 billion per year for their exploiters. That's more than Nike, Google, and Starbucks combined. And every single one of those dollars comes from a sex buyer. They're the real drivers of this industry. Not that you'd ever see that portrayed in that way in your average Hollywood movie.
She added, with all the money to be made, it's no wonder gangs and organized crime are interested in running the sex trade.
Studies showed us that in Miami, criminals made $235 million in cash via the illegal sex trade in 2007. That same year, the local drug trade netted only $96 million in cash. Black market firearm sales were around $118 million. So as far as the Miami Underground is concerned, paid sex is more lucrative than the drug and arms trade combined. And it's not just profit motivating these guys. In many cases, selling people is easier and safer than running guns or drugs.
Florida ranks third in the nation for the number of calls made to the National Human Trafficking Hotline. And even with the state's ongoing efforts to combat human trafficking, Archer said there's still more to do.
The approach to the problem needs to be different. For starters, we need more research on trafficking nationally and locally. How many victims are there in the state of Florida? In what industries? How many are trafficked here? Who is buying and selling them? Finding the answers to these questions is the first step in a reasoned and effective statewide campaign against trafficking.
Angie said it's important to think of the illegal sex trade as a business, meaning to stop it, it requires cutting off its financial support. In this case, Archer says she's talking about going after the Johns.
It's a simple idea, but you know what? It's actually working. In Chicago, Sheriff Tom Dart executed his 12th National John Suppression Initiative, where he partners with local law enforcement to go after the sex buyers who keep trafficking alive with their cash. It was his most successful effort to date, with more than 1,300 sex buyers arrested across 18 states in just one month.
Still, she did applaud the work Attorney General Pam Bondi has been doing to put a spotlight on the issue. And Bondi says she's actually talking to businesses to get them on board on recognizing the signs of human trafficking.
And we had corporate partners there from all over the country. We figured they reached over 1 million people, just the executives represented in that one room. I said, email it out to your employees. Tell them the signs to look for. Tell them to talk to their kids about opioid abuse and don't buy a drug off the street and you don't know what it is. The dangers of buying Adderall on the street, all of these drugs that are now heroin and fentanyl, and it's all wrapped into human trafficking as well, because we know that's how they get our children addicted and sucked into human trafficking often.
Bondi also encourages everyone to go to the website youcanstophd.com. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, transportation experts are pushing for a better plan in Florida for getting people with disabilities where they need to go. Regan McCarthy reports a newly created task force is taking on the issue.
Barbara Palmer is the director of the Florida Agency for Persons with Disabilities. She says one of the most difficult issues her agency deals with is helping its clients get where they need to go.
It's my opinion, since I've been with this agency, that transportation has been our biggest challenge. It is just extremely complicated.
Palmer says each county has its own system and policies in place. She gives the example of helping someone get to an ADT or adult training facility where a person with disabilities can get training for various jobs.
That ADT may be providing transportation, but in another area it may not, and it may cost $4 for the trip, and in another region it might cost $24 for a trip. So it is really, in my opinion, a messed up system.
Palmer chairs the Transportation Disadvantaged Task Force, which is looking for solutions that might help to streamline the current system while respecting the privacy and rights of the people they're working to serve. Ross Silvers, who works with the Pinellas County Transportation System, says new technology might be a help as officials work to get the most out of each ride.
You know, we all have technology, so we're entering into a computer the address of where we're going to and from. And so if we want to coordinate trips, what we need is the addresses. What we need to do is put people together by geography, not necessarily by trip purpose. And so if we can do it by geography, then we don't have to worry about if they're going to the doctor to work or for a medical appointment.
But task force members say another issue to consider is how potential changes to the systems might impact local governments, which are typically responsible for funding transportation options within their communities. The task force is expected to continue discussing the issues in the run-up to the upcoming legislative session. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capital Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capital Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capital Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.